When I walked in, Erica said, "We are going to have fun." And I thought that was a great setup for this session. I went to a lecture last week by a great cardiologist in New York, Holly Anderson, who was talking about women and heart disease. And she said that there are three simple things that women should remember when it comes to heart disease. One is exercise 20 minutes a day. This conference is making it possible for us to work and exercise all at once. The other I'm not sure we can accomplish today, which was that your bed should only be for sleep and sex. No phones, no TVs, it's just for sleep and sex. We can't get that done today, but when we go home tonight, hopefully we will get all of our work done. And then the third is that we should laugh 15 minutes a day. So hopefully we can do some of that. Hopefully we can also have some heartfelt and thoughtful conversations today. I am switching gears a little bit because I was just in this session, the one previous, up here as moderator. So switching gears to sort of being a presenter. But as Erica said in my biography, I mean, I've been a feminist activist for 20 years. And so really why they have me up here is that if you can make a career as a feminist activist, you can make a career as anything. I mean, that is like the truth of it. And I spent the first several years of my life in New York being a feminist activist, walking very proudly into any room and saying, "Oh, hi, I'm Amy, I'm a feminist activist, what do you do?" And realized that then I would spend the next 20 minutes having conversations I didn't want to have. You know, sort of, "Well, no, I do shave. I mean, I didn't for a while, but like, I do shave. And I mean, I'm a vegetarian, but that's because my mother was a vegetarian," you know, so I would have all of these conversations. And yeah, I like men. And so then I started out rather locating my feminism in what other people did. So I would say, "Well, tell me what you do." "Oh, I work at Nike." "Oh, I love Nike. I'm a big runner. You know, I love Nike shoes." And then I would go down this path. "I work at, you know, at Smith Barney. You know, what is I was at a meeting there recently because I wanted them to do some investing for this foundation I started." So I worked by sort of locating what I cared about in the context of their lives. And I think that that's been a great lesson for me personally, but it's also been a great metaphor for where feminism is today. It used to be that to be a feminist or to be a very successful woman, you really had to be singular in that. And you had to do your feminism in an exclusively feminist setting. And I think now we really have to bring, whether they're our feminist values or our humanitarian values or just our we care about other people and we care about the planet values with us wherever we go. It's no longer okay to work one place and be one person at that place and then be a different person when we come home. And I would say that that's my biggest goal for this session, is that the problem with women and work is not women. The problem is the workforce as it is. And that, as I think feminism has done for many years now, I think we too often tried to get women to adapt to society as it was being presented to us. And I think it's really our opportunity to get society to adapt to us, that it's time to switch that model. And backing up, I have to say, it's great to be here being hosted by Cisco, because one of my favorite stories, and one that is the real genesis behind a project I want to talk to you about, begins with Cisco. So I want to talk to you today about this project called Makers. And Makers began 8-9 years ago when a filmmaker who had done Henry Louis Gates' documentaries, I don't know how many people have been watching Making the Rivers, I can't remember the name of it, it's on PBS right now, for the next 5 weeks, and done a lot with civil rights and African-American rights and a lot on dead white guys, the Kennedys and Nixon, they did the dead white guy thing, Lincoln, and decided that what was missing was women. And all women. And so this filmmaker came to me and said, "I understand you know something about women. Should we do a documentary on women?" And she said, "Well, I know it's been done." And I said, "It hasn't been done. Actually, nothing's been done. I mean, there's little bits and pieces, but nothing comprehensive." And so she went back to the drawing board as a filmmaker and said, "Okay, let's focus on contemporary American women's stories. And let's look at what has happened over the last roughly 50 years in America." And it became both a film that was on PBS, Makers, Women Making America. It's also going to be launching in June and then September as a 6-part series on PBS, 6 1-hour series. And more importantly, it's this platform, makers.com, that you can go to over and over again. And it is mostly living women's stories about their lives. A lot of them have to do with the workplace. And I will say that there are a couple themes in there that are very germane to our conversation today. One is that women often make career moves, not because of them, but because of other women, that they know, and they sometimes resist career moves because of other women, that they don't want to fail because if one woman fails, they feel like they've failed all women. But they often know that. The other thing that really comes out in these profiles is that women, and this is Oprah, this is Judy Blume, this is Hillary Clinton, women saying that they wish their mother's generation had been more honest with them about what it took to have life, work life, and a family life, and what life really looked like. And so Makers is trying to bring that honesty. It's also just fun. I mean, how many people? There's Reshma Sejani, there's Hillary Clinton, there's Madeleine Albright. They're all Makers and that are here today and that are on the Makers site. And the germane point to Cisco is that one of the other things that Makers found was that, you know, when you're trying to motivate people, especially in a very traditional, entrepreneurial, innovative workplace setting, and you throw out examples of how many people know Bill Gates, how many people know Warren Buffett, you know, hands go up, what are they known for? And then I say, how many people know Sandy Lerner? I'm like, I hope the Cisco team raises their hand. and I throw out many other women's names, the hands don't go up as easily. And it's not that women have not been a part of history, they've been there. They've been there in all sectors, they've been astronauts before Sally Ride, you know, they've been tech innovators before Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa Mayer. I mean, they've been there all along. They haven't always gotten attention for it. And Sandy Lerner is the woman who, with her then-boyfriend, created Cisco because they were students at Stanford, and the Cisco people might want to adapt the story a little bit, but they wanted to figure out how to communicate across the Stanford campus. And so they created a router that became Cisco, of which the entire internet is based on. And do people know Sandy Lerner? No. And so it is amazing to me that there is still a need for Makers to retell women's stories. And we have to retell women's stories, one, to know women are there, but two, for those of us that are women and are looking for inspiration, we need to know where it is. And so I want to rely on Makers today. First of all, I want to thank Cisco for having that amazing founder. And Sandy had to go to, I think it was like 85 venture capitalists before she got initial money, and it was like the 86 that said yes. All the others had said no. But it's important because I think that women, you know, Billie Jean King has a great moment where she says, you know, you can, and other people say a version of this, you can't be it if you can't see it. And Makers is that. Makers is trying to let us see where women are, the depths of how women have been involved in these corporations and non-corporations. And it's also trying to get us to realize that success for women is often not linear. And what Makers does so well is to profile both the names we know. We've got the Oprahs and we've got, you know, the Madeleine Albrights. We have all those women. But we also have Maria Pepe, you know, the little six-year-old who wanted to play Little League and was told she couldn't because she was just a girl and girls can't play Little League. Catherine Switzer, who had to register to run the marathon in 1967 and had to register as KV Switzer because women couldn't run the marathon. And so it's also these women who just wanted to do something. It wasn't that they were trying to be crusading feminists. They just wanted to do something that somebody said no to. And I think that that is very crucial. And one of the points on KV Switzer that I will share that I love is that when she crashed the Boston Marathon in 1967, her time was 4 hours and 20 minutes in 1967. It took 5 more years from then for women to be able to legally run in the marathon. And the top man's time at that time was 2 hours and 15 minutes. Okay, jump ahead. You know, 40 however many years later, 45 years later, I got the numbers for, you know, 2012 before I got them for 2013. Men had only gained 2 minutes. Women had gained an hour and 20 minutes in their time. And to me, that analogy is exactly why something like Makers has to exist. Until we see it as an opportunity, we can't advance. Once we see it as an opportunity, we're going to catch up really hard. And who's really going to have a harder time is men. I mean, they only gained 2 minutes in 40-some years. So I think that that is what we're struggling with. I know, to be easier on the men in the room, I do think that obviously in the same way that it took the final push of the civil rights movement was often a lot of white people saying that's unfair. You know, it took the gay straight alliances to sort of really move forward. It's going to take men. And that's why we can't afford to sort of bifurcate this. And men are our friends, our husbands, the father of daughters, you know, and they are our partners in this as well, so not to divide. And so I want to use Makers in our time together today. And I want to start with Christy Haubiger, who you'll hear about her. And because of our technical difficulties, I'm going to go right from Christy into two others and then come back up and then we'll converse. So we'll start with Christy. I was like, it should just take play.
What I wanted to do was tell our stories. I wanted to change the complexion of the newsstand. For a lot of people, we were the first magazine to put them on a cover. And now you see women like Jennifer Lopez and Salma Hayek, and you think, that's not just Latina beauty, that's what American beauty looks like. I love having some small hand in changing the notion of what American beauty looks like. My parents told me I could be anything, that a young Latina could do anything. But I didn't see images in the media and stories that were consistent with what my parents were telling me. I didn't see a lot of people like me succeeding. I have a vague memory of like seeing Char on the Love Boat. Once a year, West Side Story, you're grasping at like 3 or 4 television moments a year. I remember reading all these teen magazines and feeling really unattractive and left out. My friends who are African American had grown up reading their mother's copy of Essence magazine, the largest magazine for African American women in the United States. And I always thought it was amazing that there was nothing like that but for us. I basically did a class project and wrote a business plan for a magazine for Hispanic women that I completely based on Essence magazine. And I thought, well, great, maybe I'll try and start a magazine when I graduate, and if I fail miserably, I can be a lawyer. I didn't know how hard it would be, which is fortunate. When I was trying to raise money to start Latina, I had about 15 minutes with Ed Lewis, who was like my hero, who 30 years before had started Essence magazine. I came in with a business plan, and I said, there are going to be more Hispanic women in this country than African American women in about 20 minutes, and we haven't had a magazine yet. We put together a partnership. We launched the magazine in 96. We put on the first cover this young rising star named Jennifer Lopez, who we thought might be the next big thing. To see her face on the newsstand with everybody else, I was like, wow, we look just as good. I was like, wait, we actually look better. Jennifer reappeared on the cover a number of times early on. There were so few Latinas who were famous. The reaction to the magazine launching was wonderful. I mean, just the letters from the really inspirational, my gosh, I never knew there was a Latina astronaut, to I'd never seen makeup tips on someone with my skin color. The consumers were there long before the advertisers, which makes the business really tough. I knocked on all of these doors, the makeup companies, the automotive companies. I heard the most incredible objections, the same stereotypes and the lack of positive images of Hispanic women informed their view of who we were. I had people ask me, do you think your readers can afford our product? You're selling a $5.99 lipstick at Walgreens. Like, I know a lot of poor people. They all have lipstick. We can show you the research. Have you ever seen a Latina without lipstick on? Ever? One time I had a really good day in Detroit. I'd gone to see General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, and they were all stepping up and advertising in the magazine for the first time. I felt so triumphant, and I went back to my hotel. I was, you know, wearing a suit like this, and I went down the hall to get a bucket of ice. A woman stopped me in the hallway and said, oh, wonderful, dear, are you bringing those to all the rooms? I thought of like 10 really good things to say when I got back in the room. But at the time, all I could say was, no, ma'am, just my room. Of course, she walks away puzzled. And I'm trying to decide, should I go back and polish off the mini bar? Or, no, you know what? I need to get back to work. Because until that woman sees me and thinks, wow, that looks like an entrepreneur. Or I bet that's a lawyer. Until that woman sees me and thinks that, we're not done yet. Friends joke that I'm like a sleeper cell in Hollywood. I've infiltrated the system. You can't be what you can't imagine. I wanted to change the images of Latinas in this country so that other people could see the full diversity and complexity of who we are, but also so that we could see who we are.
I grew up with very modest goals. I just wanted to have an opportunity to not become a maid like everybody else around me. I was the youngest of 12 children. My parents were tenant farmers or sharecroppers in East Texas. It was a strict household. They had to give us all kinds of rules to prevent us from being affected by the violence that surrounded us at the hands of racists. For example, we were taught how to walk on a sidewalk and step off the sidewalk when a white person was approaching. Going to school every day was a miracle for me. I just fell absolutely in love with that whole experience of learning. And I remember when I asked my mother if I could perhaps go to college one day, I think the look on her face really said it all. What an impossible idea. I was enthralled with the idea of a liberal education. I thought it was a solution for all the ills that I had seen growing up. That was the period when I really found my rebellion, writing editorials. For example, we had required chapel. And it occurred to me that, what if I were Jewish and I had to go to chapel, to a Christian service? I railed against that. What it formed in me was the ability to assert my views and then to have the courage to be alone in my views. One of my observations has been that women often suffer greatly because they do not confront financial issues easily. I remember I went to my supervisor and I said, I discovered the salary of my colleague. He is being paid considerably more than I, while I am the senior person of the two. And I only want you to know one thing. I know that this is unfair, and I will never feel the same way about working for you again. And that's all I said. So I was always unable to sit and take it, you know. I always spoke up for myself, and it worked for me. It was an opportunity, finally, at the head of a women's college, to say some things about the silent barriers that continued to exist. We started an engineering program, and I also started a finance program because of the lack of women in the financial industries. I was stunned, and I said, well, no, of course not, I can't do that. There is some part of me still from those days in Texas that feels that I'm really not all that, as the young people say. But a member of the Board of Trustees at Smith came to me and said that if you ever get an opportunity to become president of a major university, I think you should take it because it's too important historically for you to pass it up.
I am delighted to announce that the corporation has just voted that Dr. Ruth Simmons, currently president of Smith College, be named the 18th president of Brown University. Dr. Simmons is the first African American to be named to the presidency of an Ivy League institution.
What helped me most growing up is that I knew somewhere that this world I lived in, a world of segregation and bigotry, wasn't really the real world. I knew that. And what I had to do was go outside it. And that's what everybody has to do. They have to find a way to be a part of that larger world. If they do that, they'll be better problem solvers. They'll be better leaders. They'll be better mothers. They'll be better partners. They'll be better in every respect if they have that broader purview.
At Princeton, we've done a lot of things to make it possible for women to combine an academic career and raising families. One of the most, I think, original things that we have done that has made a big difference is we've created a program which is kind of emergency services program. So if you call this program at 7 in the morning, within an hour, they will have someone at your home who can stay with a sick child or wait for the Maytag repairman or take your mother to her doctor's appointment. And it just frees up women in particular, who often are the people who are having to do those extra jobs. The other thing that we've done that I think is having a very strong effect is we have added a year onto the tenure clock for every child. And we have done it automatically. You don't have to ask for that extra year. You get it automatically. When we first put the program in place, we found that the fathers were taking more advantage of the program than the mothers. And the reason is that women were afraid of taking advantage of it and of being accused of being on a mommy track. So this way, no choice, you just get the extra years. And that takes pressure off you in that period where you're trying to establish your scholarly reputation.
There's a number of reasons why I love the Maker videos. And one, ending with Sally and Princeton, is I feel like, again, going back to these microcosms, if Princeton can change, I have faith that anybody else can change. So I use it as a great model. The other thing is that, I mean, though these women's circumstances are very different and what they pursued in life was relatively different, what is the theme here is storytelling. And they each got to narrate their own life, and they each were presented with options that weren't good enough for them and that didn't really fit where they were. You know, Christy wanted out of Texas, and so a lawyer seemed to be the way to do that. And she didn't feel right being a lawyer. And then she got to be a magazine publisher, and now she's being an agent. You know, and Ruth, she wanted to be a great scholar in French literature. And I just think that that ability to sort of, you can't imagine when you're 22 what your life might be like when you're 42. And none of them set out, not only these three, but many of the makers set out to be who they were going to be. You know, there's an incident where Hillary Clinton says, I mean, I didn't know I was dating Bill Clinton who was going to be president of the United States. I mean, she was just like, I just liked this guy. And we don't know what we're experiencing right now and where it's going to lead us. What we do know is that we have control over that. We have control over shaping our lives. And that said, I do think that, you know, not to not speak to some of the men in the room, but I do think there are some specific challenges to being women in the workplace. And one of them goes to the sense of failure. You know, and Ruth, you know, I think her not being president of Brown was partly because, you know, she knew she was going to be scrutinized more being the president of a co-ed, you know, major university than being the president of a single-sex education. And there's some challenges in that. I also like that these women were leaning in long before we were told to lean in. And I do think that that is just an instinctual thing for women to be able to do. We lean in. And I think that, you know, Ruth's story, again, women sometimes have a harder time motivating if it seems too self-serving, that, oh, I can't do that because that's just about me. But how do we make it about other people? You know, and Ruth accepting at Brown, it was, you know, the colleague saying to her, you know, women, you know, we need this for as an example to all women. Women need to step up to the plate. The other thing, and I think this is, you know, and these three are not good examples of this, but I think that one challenge, and I see this a lot when I speak on college campuses, is that especially young women, they stop themselves because the assumption is that you have to be excellent. You can't be just good enough. You have to be top of your game. You have to be the best. You have to be the smartest. You have to be the best athlete. You have to do it all. And that there is the sense of if you're just being good enough, you're not leading anywhere. And I think that that stops a lot of people. And so those are some things that I think we have some control over changing in our own lives. The other things that we have to change get to sort of a little bit what Sally did. There are more institutional changes that we have to make. And I think that those are challenges, especially if we're out of a job and trying to get one. It's hard to see where that is. And if we're not feeling that we're the most senior, how do we begin to sort of make that change? And, you know, there was a story somebody told me recently of actually involved Sally, who spoke this morning, that she had been invited to give a conference a couple years ago, and they just sort of signed her up because she was one of the few women on the senior management team. And they said, it's this date. And she says, well, I won't be there. That's Halloween. I'm going to be home with my kids that day, that night. I can't go to fly to Florida. And the man said, oh, my gosh, we were all men on this planning committee. It never dawned on us that that would have been a conflict for anybody. And so instead, they switched it, and they switched not only that conference, but they went on to sort of make sure that those issues were present in any other conference planning. Now, I use that because often people are not trying to be sexist. I really don't believe that. There are a few people out there that definitely are, and you know, having been on the O'Reilly Factor, he might, in fact, be one of them. But for the most part, people just don't even realize it. And I think it's also crucial because when women are advocating, again, it's not for women. You know, it often you see this much greater benefit for everybody. There was a study got done a couple years ago. It actually looked first at France and then compared it to the United States about the whole parenting and leave. And you know, Sheryl Sandberg is famous for saying that she's at home having dinner with her kids as most as she can be, as is her husband. But not until the last 2 years did she admit that. She used to just say, "Oh, I'm running out to a meeting. I'll be on my phone, or you can reach me here." But she was always doing it. She just wasn't being public about it. And this study looking at France and the United States actually found that men were doing exactly the same thing, that men were increasingly coming home for those 5 to 7, 5 to 8 hours or checking out of work or being less available on work, but they weren't revealing it. And so I do think, again, it's what women want is ultimately what most people want. And I think that that adds a level of responsibility on women to be the ones to ask for it and to be the ones to demand it. Now, specific to more of you in this room, that I think, you know, in the last session I did a show of hands, and the three questions that were indirectly asked was, who is not inspired at their job? And that was one question. And the other one was, who has that gut feeling when you're going into work every day that says, I don't want to go to the job, I don't want to be doing that? And there were tons of those. And then the other one was a stat that I had not known, that there are 4 million baby boomer women who are out of the traditional workforce and at home taking care of their kids. And I don't know if those same people are in this room, but there was a lot of the people that fit that demographic in the last session. And I think that what Makers does and what I used Makers for is to show you in some ways that there are women who have made very traditional choices about their work and made their work work for them. They have been able to get the workplace to change to fit their evolving needs and demands. And I think, I really believe that that's possible. I believe that whatever place you're in, that it just takes you asking. And that once you ask, other people are going to say, oh, I didn't even think of that. Of course we should do that. Why didn't I think of that? And that there can be greater change from where you're standing. What I can offer is somebody who has not been in a traditional workplace is how much you can make it up, you know, and how much you can make your own workplace and make it reflect you. You know, I was raised by a very hardworking single mother, and yet I always laugh that I never thought I had a working mother because I could always call her and I could always go by her office. And so I felt like I never really fit into the working parent thing because to me that symbolized a parent being unavailable. And I felt like my mother was always available. But what I got from that example was it never dawned on me that I would not work or not be a mother because my mother's example was so overshadowing in my life that it was like, of course I'll do it. So it was not even a debate. So I didn't have that moment of like, should I work or stay home? That was not my debate. But what became clear to me is that I wanted to be able to work and have a family life. And so how could I do that? And I'm the type of worker that, you know, gets up, takes my kids to school, and then I don't leave my desk for lunch or anything until, you know, 5 o'clock at night. And then occasionally I'll sneak out and then I'm back on my computer from 9 p.m. until 1 a.m. And that works for me. That doesn't work for everybody, but that works for me. And I think that any company would be so smart to hire working parents because I think that it just forces you to be so much more focused in your job because you know that there's this other thing. And, you know, the other Sheryl Sandberg, you know, takeaway point is that you have to have the job you love before you have kids because that's it's going to be harder to go to work when there's something at home that you love more. And so having a career that you really love. And I do think when I'm meeting with college students, I feel sad because I've been doing feminist work for 25 years. I've been quoting the same stats. I mean, every year we get a few more senators. Every year, you know, we get the blip on, you know, let's hope Hillary runs for president. Like, we get these changes out there in society that ripple out, and we can say women are making progress. But when you look at the hard numbers, when you look at the amount of money women make, when you look at women in senior positions, it's not changed much. And I think that it's not going to change that much because I think that success, more or less defined from a more female-sensitive perspective, isn't linear. You know, it's gradual. Catalyst has done some amazing studies on this, that at a certain point, women would prefer to plateau their careers in exchange for more flexibility and more time at home. They don't want, you know, when you've made enough money, more money isn't enough of a motivator. And so that financial is not. Now, granted, I've had it argued back, and I believe it, that women are often in a relationship with a man who maybe also brings some financial security to their freedom. But I also think that women, when push comes to shove, would exchange that flexibility for the greater income. And so I think that if we're constantly trying to, both personally but also generationally, get women to be successful in that traditional way, we're still going to be stagnant, because I don't think that that's the success many women want to see. And so we need to create workplaces that reflect that. We need to recruit. And work and family is, I think, the default, that's what women want. There's a great man right down the road, Stuart Friedman, at Wharton, you know, Center for Work-Life Balance, and many people have probably worked with him, and he went into companies and said that the second he just switched it to work-life, many more people were like, oh, yeah, that works for me. I wanted to train for a marathon. I wanted to get a pilot's license. And so finding the right language to describe what we're really talking about. We're not really talking about, I mean, most mothers I know want time to pick up the dry cleaning. It's not taking care of the kids. It's like the other, make the doctor's appointments. It's the other little things. And so what is the language that we're using to describe our scenario? I feel like we've spent a morning being talked at, and so I really want to, before I go on any further, I really want to invite some of you up to the microphones, and we'll start taking some questions, because I know that in the last session there were about 30 hands raised, and I got to like 4 people. So in the 25 minutes we have left, I really want to make sure that what I say is reflecting back a little bit what is on your hearts and minds. So if people want to come up and ask questions, like I can just keep... I'm like, there couldn't have been that many people in the last session and nobody in this session.
Hi there.
Hi.
Can you
say your name, too, when you come
up? Sure. Yeah, my name is Faina Bucher. I'm the assistant coordinator for the UNH Women's Studies Program. Mm. And thank you so much for showing that film. I've only seen it like 7 times teaching it. But I always get really kind of emotional watching it. And I work with college students, and so I am always trying to find a way to make it obvious to them all the things that you're saying now. And I feel like feminism is still this F word, right? Students, especially college-age students, are really nervous about it and aren't sure if they have the buy-in, they're feminists but, or they're not feminists but. And so I was just hoping that you could maybe talk to us about either, you know, our children or the students that we're working with if we're in a higher ed environment. How can we get them to buy in to the feminists? You know, movement still.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the feminist word is not perfect, and it definitely comes with as much baggage as it comes with as much confidence. You know, it can be a great reward for people to find themselves in a community, but I agree it comes with a lot of baggage. And what I actually hear more young people saying when they don't want to identify with feminism is they actually feel a pressure for that greatness. They feel like, oh, but feminists were so brave, and feminists were willing to go on strike, and feminists were willing to, you know, take these superpower jobs, and feminists are amazing people in some ways, that they're triumphant. And I think that what people are saying sometimes, and more often when I'm hearing it, when they don't want to be a feminist, is like, I don't know if I can do all of that. Like, I don't know if I can be that good all the time. I kind of like Valentine's Day. I kind of like that my boyfriend pumps the gas. I mean, like, there's those simple ways that I think we indulge being female, and we think we have to give that up if we're going to be a feminist. And then there's other ways where I don't know if I want the burden of being the breadwinner. Like, I don't know if I want that. That's a lot of responsibility. And so I think sometimes you have to start by figuring out what are they resisting in the word feminism. And again, back to my one example. I mean, I have 2 friends who were the most adamantly not a feminist. Like, they would say to me, I'm not a feminist, not a feminist. They coincidentally seem to be my 2 friends who went into finance and who stayed in finance. And nothing satisfied me more than when they were back to work after they had their 2nd child. Both of them are also married to investment banker husbands, and had learned that they were both passed up for promotions. And it was because, oh, well, women don't come back after their 2nd kid, especially if you have a man at home who's making similar amounts of money. Both of them stayed in the workplace, said to me in a very indirect way, this is why I'm going to keep working, and I can't believe, and they said it in their own ways, but they said, now I get what you were talking about with feminism. And so sometimes you have to experience it before you're going to get it. Now, I think that's unfortunate, because I think that that's wasted time. If you're willing to recognize it sooner, we can help people on that journey sooner. But I think getting students to recognize, I was speaking at a high school recently, Andover in Massachusetts, you know, very privileged, you know, institution, and these girls were like, but I don't feel discriminated against. And I said, you know, it doesn't surprise me. You're one of the most elite institutions in the world, and you are 50%. And all those things. And I said, well, let me just throw out one thing to you. In middle school, did you ever have a dress code imposed on you? And all the girls were like, yes, I couldn't wear tank tops that were shorter than this, and my skirts had to be. And, you know, I said, and when you go to your sports games, do you feel like girls' sports get as many fans as boys' sports? And they're like, no. And so sometimes it is also showing them, because I do think that we tolerate things more than we should. You know, I think that we've been so conditioned that we accept it. And so I think that we're not seeing what we're not seeing, and we don't know what's out there.
My name is Yasmin, and 7 years ago I used to have a mid-management job. And between that time and now, I've been a stay-at-home mom, which is a better title that I prefer than a homemaker, personally. So now that I'm a mom, I volunteer at schools and do a lot of activities that are involved with my children. But in 2.5 years, my daughter's a freshman at college, and in 2.5 years, my son will graduate from high school. So I need to go back to a career, and it's a different career that I'm looking into. But how am I going to be taken seriously from being a stay-at-home mom to a career person, because I haven't been exposed to the person that I was as a career person before my homemaker. And I used to be in Canada when I had my job, and I'm in the States now. So nobody around me that knows me is familiar with the kind of job that I was involved with.
Well, assuming you want a job in a more conventional setting, I mean, what they're hiring for is a skill set. You know, they're not necessarily hiring because you came from this company or you came from this. And so it's, in some ways, very tangibly just taking your resume and making it about the skills that you have. And skills that didn't go away when you became a parent, you know, and that's probably added to the different skill sets that you have. And so it's making sure that gets illuminated. And the volunteering, you know, and somebody said it in this last session, and it's true. Volunteering is still a job. It just means you're not getting paid for it. You know, there is still work being done that would otherwise need to be paid by somebody else if you weren't there doing it. And so it is a position. It is a job. It is skills that are required. And so I think making, again, those opportunities read what they are or reflect what they are, which is a long-term commitment. I mean, hopefully it's not just like I stuffed goodie bags here and I stuffed, you know, but there is these longer-standing commitments of, you know, I raised $1 million, you know, I am an event planner, I'm skilled at this, you know, and it's making sure those things come about. And I actually do. I think it's a real, you know, having been deeply a part of the nonprofit community, it is way too dependent upon this volunteer structure, and it's a challenge because it's often being done by women who are not being remunerated for it, and it's dependent upon that. So it's these conflicting messages that it's dependent upon women not being otherwise salaried that have the time to do this. And, you know, I do think it's a matter of how you present yourself, and because I'm a working mother, I hear people present different selves to me because I have friends who are stay-at-home moms who feel really guilty that they're stay-at-home moms, and so they'll either say, "Oh, I'm just a stay-at-home mom," and they really discount everything they're doing. And then I have other friends who feel like she thinks I'm just a stay-at-home mom, and I'm going to show her. And so I'm going to say, "Oh, did you read that article in the New York Times? Because I went and I called this, and they really show up and they want to like impress me in this way." And I think that it is about who you think you are and how you present yourself. You know, because being a stay-at-home parent, I mean, it's also tricky in my life. A lot of women I know who are stay-at-home parents but also full-time nannies, and so then I'm a little bit like, now, what are you doing exactly? But that's but that's a different category of person. And on that, you know, I had a friend recently whose kids are in school full-time, and this is an interesting story, and her husband said, I would like an accounting of your hours because if we're going to keep paying the nanny full-time, I'm not sure how I can why we should justify that. Now, at first, I was very offended by this. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, he's kind of right. Like, you're paying a nanny full-time, and the kids are in school from 8 to 3, and and somebody astutely pointed out to me, they said, well, she should turn around and ask him for an accounting of his hours, too, for what he's doing. But I do think that it is a matter of what you present about yourself, and it's sort of arriving and saying, oh, I'm just a stay-at-home mom. Or, oh, but I've just been a, you know, I hear that a lot from women, but just sort of saying, oh, I'm very active, and I have friends that way, and I'll listen to them, and I'll think, oh, my gosh, listening to you, I really would think that you run NRDC. Like, the way you talk about that is amazing. So I do think it's finding out what are the contributions you're specifically making and putting that face forward.
Thank you. Hi, Jody Lurie from Janney.
I wanted to kind of touch on the point where you talked about how in order for women to really advance, we need to have the other side, the male side, supporting us and really sort of being open to it. And I found, you know, not necessarily blatantly, but I found situations where men just don't want women there and actively try to exclude them, whether it be a fantasy football league or something of that nature. And even when you bring up the topic with them, then they start getting more nervous about it because they know that what they're doing is wrong. How do you approach those situations in such a way that it brings to light the idea of exclusion and doesn't do it in such a way that you're then setting yourself apart from them, making it so they don't want to include you?
I think it's hard because I know that women really want their women-only time. You know, women want women's conferences, and women want book clubs that are women, and women want their brown bag lunches. And so I feel like I can't argue that women should be able to have that time and men shouldn't be able to have that time. You know, and so I'm not arguing against how people want to do those things. It's when the advantages are benefiting you in your career, and that's a disadvantage. That's putting certain gender people at a disadvantage. And that said, you know, somebody who had worked at Goldman Sachs for a long time was just telling this anecdote about how there were three people contending for that top place at Goldman Sachs, and now that man Lloyd has it. But apparently at the time there were two women who were in the running, and they were equally, but when they came down to making the final decision, advocating for women was a negative for them, but advocating for women was seen as a positive for him, why he could be up there heading the company. And so I do think that it's this, I think it's a challenge, because it's both feels like you have your space, I don't have mine. But if that space is meant for career advancement, how can I get access to it? And I think that, you know, finding that, you know, Condoleezza Rice talks a lot in her Makers video about how, you know, she grew up the only child of a father who loved football. So she can get in there and she can talk football, like, and she really knows her stuff, and how she'll really use it manipulatively, like in some settings, and just be like, I got football fans over here. And, you know, but knowing when it's appropriate. And I think that that's one of the, is if you're too, and I hate saying this because it's something you don't often say, but is when women say that, it feels like, oh, you're just doing it for the sake of doing it. It's like you're just trying to break in to prove that, you know, there's that it doesn't have to be all men. And I think recognizing that, but then finding the times where it does not have to be all men. You know, when are the opportunities, when it should be more integrated. And I do think that what people see for their peers is it feels like a threat. Women are taking over. Women are getting the majority of undergraduate degree educations. Women don't need any help. Women don't need assistance. And yet women are not, it doesn't translate into incomes. But I think the second you can bring it down to, like, a daughter, you know, I loved watching the men watch girls soccer, you know, and you see it, and you're like, oh, all of a sudden they care about equal rights and equal opportunity and equal court time and field time. And so I think that if you can translate that a little bit, honestly, making it personal, there's some instances when making it personal can help. And then I think also proving yourself. You know, I was always the girl that wanted to be picked to be on the kickball team. And first, because I felt like that was a real badge of honor, or the only girl in the physics class. But then I realized that I was actually, that was a negative to other women, that I was like, oh, I'm the best girl. And really I wanted to be the best kickball player, but I wasn't afforded that opportunity. So I also think showing that you're interested in it is really about the skills, and it's really something that you care about and that you would do separate of your corporate environment.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Boone. Can you say a little bit more about the language and the labels that we use when we're talking about women's issues, feminist issues? Because, you know, I find the phrase work-life balance very interesting. I disagree with it because I think we all just have our lives and we spend them in different ways, and it's about how we make our choices. Mm-hmm. And the label in particular, you know, we talk about working mothers, but we don't have those same conversations about the working fathers. It's just assumed that that's their role in life. So can you talk more about the power, the advantages, the disadvantages of the language and the labels we use?
Mm-hmm. Well, you made me think that I went to meet with people in the Obama administration with a group of people about 18 months into his first term, and they were feeling like there was a crisis, that they hadn't been able to recruit enough women. And when they were looking at some of the things, one of the things was that the average term of an appointment is 18 months. And I said, is there a reason it have to be 18 months? Couldn't it be 22 months or 24 months? And they said, well, I guess so, but why would that make a difference? And I said, well, I just think from a woman's perspective, that's two school years, not one. And they're like, really? And I was like, really? But the thing that really offended me was that they, women who had children, they would ask of the women who had children, not of the men who had children, if they had paid their nanny tax. And I point that, I mean, that was back to the Zoe Baird debacle under Clinton's administration, but I point that out because we do still expect things that are women and we don't expect them. And I think that we have to do this in our own subtle ways. We have to start asking it of men. You know, I have friends where I do it in subtle ways, where I wonder what the kid wants for the birthday, and I make a point of calling the dad and saying, oh, what do you think you might want for his birthday? So there's these little ways that I think we have control over it and reworking those expectations. And then I think in a larger way, I mean, unfortunately, I grew up in the height of the sort of PC wars, and so I know that there's this challenge around using language that's authentic and using language that's appropriate. That said, I think that, you know, we need to always be ahead of the curve, and even if it's just for, you know, being politically correct, we need to be using language that is pushing us in that direction further and further. And I think that some of the languages I see within, you know, the work family, is the work life is one of them. And even the flex time, you know, it sort of is this like assumption that flex time is like, oh, I want to just check out. And then, but it's like, really what I want is I want to be the best employer I can to you. I want to show up, you know, as Beth Rubio was saying in the last session, like, I don't want my employees to lie to me about why they're coming in. I want to create an honest work environment. And so just being honest, like, I'm coming in late today because I'm going to a doctor's appointment. I will stay till 7. You know, you're going to get the most out of them, and you're going to create the best if you can be transparent about what that is. And luckily, more and more people at workplaces, I think, are seeing that back and reflecting it. I mean, you know, when I get asked to do things, I was saying in the last session that I just say no. I mean, I say yes to a lot of things, but when it's something I don't want to do, I just say no, because I often am saying no because of a kid-related thing, or I just want to be home. I mean, that's like another reality. But I know that if I say no because of a kid thing, I'm worried that it marks me in the workplace, so I'm just like, no, unfortunately, that won't work. But I feel bad about that because I should be able to feel more honest about what it is and what the demands on my time are and how I have to manage them, and then really knowing that when I say yes, I really mean yes. And so I think how to appropriately integrate that out of work life into our workplace life is tough. And some people would say, you don't have to. Don't bring your out-of-work life into your workplace. I don't care. and I just don't know that that's possible. There was a great story. There's a company in Vermont. I'm blanking on the name of it. It's like a Patagonia-esque company. There's a university in Southern Illinois. This is a better example. And they had a shooting on their campus, which was very sad and devastating. And as part of the healing, they had service dogs on campus. And people realized that they loved the dogs so much. The other thing they did is to help support faculty. They brought faculty into the classroom to be there as a support mechanism. Okay, months go by. And people realize that they still want the dogs and they still want the other faculty. Whereas previously they thought the faculty were critiquing them, and that didn't feel supportive. And they also felt like the dogs were distracting. It was bringing your personal life. But they realized that it made a community feel more like a community and made us not feel competitive. And so I think that what was under the guise of crisis actually ended up being this sort of naturally holistic thing. So I also think using things that being very tangible in what it is and showing it rather than telling it. Because I think the second we start to tell it is when language becomes such a binary. And it becomes, we have to do this because women are behind, because women aren't paid as much. But if we can sort of show what our company would look like and how our whole company would benefit, that'll go longer. But I recognize it's a challenge. I mean, it started out with like chairman and chairwoman. You know, there was those little ways. But I think there's more subtle ways that we can do it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Janet Benton. I'm a writer and editor. And I'm very interested in, I'd love to talk to you afterwards because I'm working on some documentaries on Philadelphia women's history, but also in terms of combining motherhood and work, or perhaps parenthood and work. I love the catalyst.org website, and they have that great list of, you know, what's available in this country, and boy, I'd really like to live in Sweden or Spain, where you can work 75% at 75% salary until your child is 8. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been reading people's various recommendations about, you know, oh, we should have 6 months paid leave, and wouldn't that be amazing? That's really not amazing. That really stinks. I mean, a year paid leave really stinks. You know, we need a paradigm shift in this culture so that we can take care of our children. They don't stop needing us when we're one. And we also want to work, and we want to have meaningful work. You know, and it's particularly a crisis, obviously, for women who are working at minimum wage and relying on public benefits. I just wondered if you have thoughts about What kind of a paradigm shift would be your fantasy in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I went to Russia years ago at the invitation of the State Department, and I was doing these meetings with women's groups in Russia, and there were USAID and USDPA sponsored, and they all said to me, how do you assess gender? And I said, well, surely there's a document on that. I'll get back to the United States, and I'll call Ford, and I'll call Gates, and I'll get that to you. And I called all those people I know that do assessment from a gender perspective, and nobody had this document that I wanted. And in terms of what does it really mean to be good for women? What does it really mean to look like that? And so I spent 3 years complaining about how this didn't exist, and I tried to get everybody I know to do it. And then I really started just collecting my own little stories about what it means. And some of it is, you know, from their perspective, you know, there was a company that sort of looked at why they, who gets promoted to leadership. And it often has to do with a lot of public speaking opportunities. And women were the least likely to sort of volunteer for those opportunities. They didn't feel right. So they recognized that and they said, oh, let's give public lecture trainings. Let's give in-house training to make that, to give women and men who want it, you know, that better edge up. The other thing was humor, that women don't like to talk because they don't think they're funny. But that's a joke-telling way. I do think that women have, Tina Fey, there's like so many examples of women being funny, but no, they're not Billy Crystal, they're not the stand-up Jerry Seinfeld, they're not going to give you a joke. But again, teaching, like redefining what we think of as humor. Is humor just to incite laughter? You know, women are capable of that and getting women to realize that. Another thing was these traditional things, like all women in corporate America felt like they had to learn how to play golf before they got this job. And recognizing that there were a lot of men who felt really like they had to go out and learn to play golf. And then a lot of people didn't really want to play golf. I mean, a lot of people really do. But also redefining what it meant. It meant quality time, you know, and how can we redefine that? So I think our first problem is that we don't even know what it looks like. Like, we don't even know how I think we all know that we want it. We want workplaces to be more responsive and respectful of all of its employees, and I think that feels particular to the women employees because they've not always been prioritized in that. But I also think that we don't know what it looks like. So one, we have to define it, and I think two, we have to implement it. And we have to really collect the examples where it's worked. I love an example of Princeton. Add a year onto the tenure clock, you know, that will change, you know, the ripple effect. One of the things that MIT did was that they looked for their tenure is what they required of tenure was publishing. And they actually don't say where they want you to be published, but people had assumed it to be X, Y, and Z. Well, they went ahead and said, no, we don't care about X, Y, and Z. That's great, but we also care about, and then renamed these places, you know, it wasn't as blatant as like, oh, we want you to be published in this magazine, but really expanded and not only named the places where you were obvious, but really named the unobvious places and sort of gave them value in the same space and said, be published here. We want you to be published. We want your word to be out there. And so I think we have to define it, and then we have to really come up with the examples, and hopefully it'll change. Let me quickly, can you both ask the same question at the same time? I mean, you go, and then you go, and then hopefully we'll get it out. And then you go, and then hopefully we can get it in. Go ahead, right over here. Yeah.
Okay, really quickly then. My name's Juliana. I work at Grant Thornton. And I was just interested. I'm 25. I just started my career. I'm almost 2 years into my job, fresh out of college. And my manager is a working mother. And she, sometimes I actually get frustrated because she's often not available. And to me, directly working with her, sometimes I don't feel supported. And, you know, but also it kind of scares the crap out of me. I'm like, oh, no, I hopefully would like to be a mother. And, you know, how do I balance that? And, you know, as somebody who's not quite there yet, not quite there in their career, I only have to take care of myself and my career and my, you know, I don't have a family. I don't have a husband yet. So what would you say for people around my age who are just coming to be, we're the new generation to come up in the workforce to have families? What's your advice to us, and how? What can we do, you know, in our workspace?
Yeah, I'll go back here and then.
I actually have a kind of a similar question to that. My name's Amy. I'm a woman in my 30s who has chosen not to have children, and I feel like I'm often vindicated at my job because I don't have a family at home that I have to go to. So I can work the extra hours. I can work the holidays. That's okay. Amy's there. She doesn't have anyone at home. I do have a life outside of work. I actually volunteer a lot. I have a women's group that I do in New Jersey, so it's very frustrating that because I don't have children that I'm not valued.
Thank you. No, I hear that a lot.
So what's your advice for them?
Yeah.
How do I get that respect and that time and work-life balance because I don't have that?
Yeah. Do you have a similar question, or are you?
My name is Elizabeth Williams, and I'm a city council person. What I feel would, as an idea for a lot of the young people that's out in the work field, is to establish your own business, even if you just have the name. I found out that me and my sister and I, we did that, and what happened was, one time I went to purchase something, and they had that on my list for credit. So they said, how long have you had this business? And when I gave them the estimate of how long I had the business, I was able to really, really build on that. Mm-hmm. So if you have, like, your own business, and what you're doing when you do your resume, you put that on your resume while you're still at home, because I was also an at-home parent, and I kept that going. So that's like 20 years of work experience, whether I volunteered or no matter what I did, I put that on there under my own business, and I also have we also have an I number with that. So I'm just throwing that out there.
That's a great example. I'll just quickly answer the similar. One of the things, and Marissa Mayer says this, you know, when she was at Google, she met with her team of people and sort of said, what sometimes makes you hate being at work? Like, what's the thing that keeps you? And for some women, it was kids. You know, for some of the men on her team, it was also kids. And for one man, he says, you know, every Tuesday night, like, my college friends, we just cook dinner together, and, like, my friends from college. And when I miss that, I really resent work. And they came up with this list of things. But what was really crucial about it is that it was often, as even people who had kids, it was equally kid-related things and non-kid-related things. And I think having that conversation in your workplace, and then what came out of that is people feeling more supported and people feeling like they could ask for your help. Like, oh, Amy, I know tonight is your night to do this. Do you mind, you know, tonight's your night to watch Buffy, and then my night is like, I'm going to do this. So can we swap? Would you mind being on this and I would be on this? But I think just showing what it is that you have out of life. And I think that... And this is also a generational question. I've run up against a lot of women who are older than me and who had kids and who feel like, nobody helped me, why should I help you? Like, what is that? I do think that's rare, you know, and I think more and more what somebody like your boss might want is like, I know you're really distracted. Is there something I can do I know that your 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock is really busy, you know, can I cover for that? And then in exchange, you know, can I do that? I also think find other mentors, because there are a lot of other people out there who have really good balances, and make sure you can see it as a possibility. And that said, you know, when I was in my 20s, I was like a salivating dog. I would go to anything, you know, and I'd be like, sure, free food after work, I'll go to that event, or I'll stay. You know, the volume of all-nighters I pulled in my 20s, I mean, it's crazy. Like, I would miss Thanksgiving because I'd have to do a mail. I mean, I would just be crazy. And yet I don't resent it. It was wonderful. And then by the time I got to my 30s, it wasn't so much because of kids. Kids became a good excuse, but it was I couldn't go at that pace anymore. You know? So in some ways, absorb it. You know, take advantage of the fact that you're willing to be there and show up and be on time and take full advantage of your workplace. And know that if you do want, it's probably going to shift at some point. You know, and it can shift gradually, but know that you did all that you could to maximize the today, and then that will carry you through for when you have that. Thank you all. I know it's rush and it's time to go, but thank you very much. And thank you, Cisco and Erica. 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 Thank you, Cisco.